You're listening to Classic Dialogues, Land Power in the Indo-Pacific, a China Land Power Study Center production. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government. I am Colonel Rich Butler, the director of the Classic. Today, we're talking with Mr. Marcus Garlaskis, the director of the Indo-Pacific Security Initiative at the Atlantic Council. Moreover, he's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, and has also served as a national intelligence officer for North Korea and the chief of strategy at U.S. Forces Korea on the Korean Peninsula. He is an expert intelligence analyst and strategist who has spent a career looking at the region. Today, we will be chatting about why we should think about the potential for a protracted war in the Indo-Pacific and what lessons we should be learning and analyzing about the topic. So without further ado, Marcus, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it.
Before we dive into the really weighty questions we're going to get into on protracted war, can you tell me a little bit about your program, the IPSI?
So the Indo-Pacific Security Initiative is part of the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security within the Atlantic Council. And we focus on the main security challenges in the Indo-Pacific, particularly China's rising threat to the rules-based international order and North Korea's increasing nuclear capabilities and destabilizing behavior and weapons advancements, and look at how we can work with allies and partners to meet those challenges together. And so one of our signature issues has actually been deterrence and preparing for conflict, even full-scale war in the Indo-Pacific, all the different pathways that it could take. And so we've written a series of reports on these subjects, some short-form work, videos, tabletop exercises, including the Guardian Tiger series, which I know you're well familiar with. I think we are helping to move the ball on this question of protraction. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
All right. Thanks, Marcus. We've talked a lot, and this is one in a few of a series of podcasts on protracted war that we've been working on. Can I just start with a blanket question of how should we be considering and why should we be considering the potential for a protracted war in the Indo-Pacific?
Rich, thanks for the question. This is a really important topic, and it's one actually that's been getting increasing attention lately. So we just recently published a piece from one of our non-resident fellows, Brian Kerr, that has the really appropriate title here, that there will be no sharp war. A fight between the U.S. and China would likely go on for years, or something to that effect. And I think Brian has really caught on to, as have many of us who've been studying this issue, to the idea that there's so much focus on how the first couple of weeks of a conflict between the U.S. and China might go, that there's been insufficient focus on the fact that it likely won't end after 2 weeks. And the more that you look at history, you look at tabletop exercises and war games, the more that you discover it's unlikely that decisive results would be achieved in a short time frame. And certainly, it takes such an overwhelming advantage of military power and an overwhelming advantage of morale, really, historically, to be able to achieve that short, sharp war, that quick victory, the fait accompli that China might be looking for. So in the event that a conflict does begin, and say, you know, Taiwan being sort of the pacing case that we were always looking at in the U.S. national security community, if you're not going to presume that that Taiwan simply lacks the will to continue the fight, again, history and I think wargaming tabletop exercises show that it just won't be possible for China to achieve the quick, decisive result that it may be looking for, at least not within the time frame of the next few years, unless something really unusual, a discontinuity happens in terms of where the will and capability of the different actors end up. And so China may be hoping for a short, sharp war, but what we should be preparing for and what we should be ensuring is that if China does try to start a conflict in the Indo-Pacific, that it won't be short and sharp, that the ability to continue to fight and to impose costs on China is sustained. And that may be the thing that deters the war. And so I think it's this lack of preparedness for the fight lasting longer might actually even undermine deterrence. So that's one of the reasons why we need to focus on it. Now as to the reasons besides just what we see from history and from for games and tabletop exercises. We can also see that the potential for the conflict to escalate vertically and horizontally as it develops increases the potential for protraction. And so if it does look like the PRC is going to achieve that that short, sharp victory, then there's certainly a lot of incentive for the U.S., for its allies and partners, to deny China the ability to achieve that victory through escalation. And of course, it's also a very real possibility that North Korea, for example, would see China winning and decide there is their moment for opportunistic aggression, just as an example. And conversely, if the PRC looks like it's going to lose that war quickly, that gives it escalation imperatives, gives it the incentive to escalate geographically, to strike U.S. bases in the region, to increase their chances of achieving that quick victory. It increases the incentive similarly for China to encourage North Korean involvement, to prevent their defeat, to tie down U.S. forces, to tie down allied forces potentially. And it also increases the potential that the PRC decides that a limited nuclear strike, perhaps, you know, in the region, perhaps not on the island itself, would be a way to prevent a stalemate and allow China to maintain the offensive momentum to be able to seize Taiwan. So these are all, different possibilities, different scenarios, but they all lead back to the idea that if there is a pathway to a short, sharp victory, because war is a contest of wills and capability, and a set of complex interactions, it's likely then the adversary will do everything it can to actually take things off of the path of that short, sharp war. And so to go back to where I started, that makes it all the more imperative for us to prepare for a protracted conflict, not just to be ready for what the war might look like, but also to ensure that the PRC understands that a quick victory just simply isn't in the cards, and that will help reinforce deterrence.
You're describing something interesting to me. We've talked about it here on the podcast before about a little bit of a cognitive disconnect. What led you to want to do this research?
So I think it really begins with my time in U.S. Forces Korea, where, again, these scenarios that are often talked about in terms of what a war on the Korean Peninsula would look like seem to presume oftentimes that essentially the conflict for all intents and purposes would be decided quickly. There's this kind of broad assumption, often made that, essentially the war would be decided so rapidly because it would be in North Korea's interest to push the conflict to a conclusion before the ability of the U.S. to reinforce comes into play. And that similarly, that the tremendous firepower available to the U.S. and ROK combined forces would quickly impose unacceptable costs on North Korea. But I think many of us came to question that sort of mindset that you often see out there in public, recognizing the terrain on the Korean Peninsula, the tremendous amount of combat power involved, and the difficulty really in achieving a decisive result, right? I mean, even in 1950, when North Korea had this overwhelming, military advantage over South Korea, We didn't see the ability of North Korea to quickly overrun the peninsula before the U.S. could reinforce. And so if you look at the Korea case sort of as a model and how difficult it is to achieve a quick, decisive victory there, I think it definitely ports to other conflicts in the Indo-Pacific. And so I particularly became interested in the potential for simultaneous conflicts and how that relates to protraction. Because as you game this out, as you look at tabletop exercises, for example, it becomes clear the incentives, as I said before, for either China or for the U.S. and its allies and partners are to escalate if it looks like the enemy is about to win that short, sharp victory, win that decisive context in a short period of time. And so even though the way in which the PRC and the U.S. and allies and partners would pursue that sort of approach in the event of conflict differ, Right. In the end, the result is the same, that it's likely to cause the conflict to expand to involve more countries in a larger geographic area. And it's also likely to intensify in terms of the escalation ladder of not just the types of weapons used, but also the targets that are struck. And increasingly likely then that would include going after after targets that disrupt the ability to sustain the fight, and not just the immediate forces that are engaged in combat. So those are some of the factors involved. And I think one of the ones that also jumped out really at me is this increasing capability and apparent intent for limited nuclear attacks, right? And so people often think of nuclear conflicts as being something that's going to bring a conflict to an end very quickly. But I think in reality, when you look at it realistically, the potential for a limited nuclear attack, not escalating to a full scale nuclear exchange, but just leading to a conventional stalemate and a transition in the nature of conflict, that's also a very real possibility. So I think there's a lot of realistic pathways to protection, whereas the pathways to a quick, decisive outcome really require a bunch of variables to line up that I think are unlikely to line up in reality.
That's fair. And I think as you think about protraction in terms of getting past like the first stalemate and moving deeper into a fight, what you're describing there in terms of either an expansion of the conflict that goes geographically horizontally and involves more of our allies and partners, or some limited amount of escalation that changes dynamics short of a full-on nuclear war, is territory that we need to explore that we haven't really looked at in 30, 40 years in any sort of detail. Your insights onto the simultaneity piece are pretty interesting to me, because we choose to fight with allies and partners all the time. That's what we build our national defense strategy on. We're strong as a joint military, but we're able to work with those allies and partners, and they contribute to the collective defense, and as well as we can contribute to their collective defense. So I think that's worthy of, if we flip the coin over, should we be thinking about the combination of potential simultaneity and some of the work you've been doing with your team at the Atlantic Council writ large in terms of collusion among potential allies and partners of any of the authoritarians we go to war with, whether that in the Indo-Pacific be the Chinese or the North Koreans or potentially the Russians in some form?
Yeah, I think this potential for a simultaneity and collusion between the authoritarian actors is really the possibility that's so tightly intertwined with the potential for protraction. In particular, if you look at in the European context of what's going on with Russia's campaign against Ukraine right now, it's clear that Russia would not have been able to sustain this protracted offensive against Ukraine if it had not been for the tremendous amount of resources that the PRC has been providing to Russia. And a lot of this is documented very clearly in open source trade statistics. And so you can argue about exactly where the red line exists between lethal and non-lethal aid. But basically, China is providing enough dual-use materials and components. Basically, it's fueling Russia's war machine. And then you got the North Koreans directly providing the missiles and even artillery shells that Russia is using to sustain the offensive. You got the Ukrainians providing UAVs. All this is very well documented. Defense Intelligence Agency has actually released some great unclassified products on these elements. And so it could easily, though, end up working in the other direction, where Russia is able to provide materials that would sustain China's war effort. North Korea could provide things, but also North Korea could help to protract the conflict again by conducting its own offensive operations. And then again, Iran and others potentially have a role, and not just directly supporting the conflict, like the Iranians sending the drones to Russia, but also making the conflict more protracted by tying down additional U.S. and allied attention and combat power in other regions of the world, either directly or through proxies. But of course, the example being Iran's ability to sustain and foster aggression by proxies in the Middle East that then consume U.S. and ally and partner resources that would otherwise be used to bring the conflict to a quicker close.
From your analysis, two questions. In the here and now, are you getting some bounce on this message in terms of how we should be thinking a little bit differently and what that means both for analysts and academics and policymakers and military practitioners? And secondly, where do you think we need to take this type of analysis in the future to be useful?
No, Rich, we absolutely are getting some bounce. I think we're getting attention, in the broader national security community. Now, how much that's directly impacting in the near term, you know, plans, policy, and strategy, that's hard to say, and particularly hard to say, in a public forum. But I think clearly the conversation is changing, and what we like to call, it has been called the Overton window, right? That window of the acceptable discourse of what is the range of things that are that can be discussed as potential policies or approaches. I see the Overton window is definitely moving toward the idea of having to, at the very least, deter additional adversaries from joining a conflict, if not actually having to fight them simultaneously. And that very, very closely is connected also to, I think, the increasing traction that we're getting for protraction as a concept, and as the highlighting this risk of limited nuclear attacks, and that how that could actually paradoxically not bring a conflict to a higher level of escalation quickly, but could actually be one of the contributors to the protraction of the conflict, either because it causes a conflict to stalemate, or because it causes hesitation about how quickly we want to escalate to a particular level because of the risk that it would go nuclear, like you see right now going on in Ukraine. So I think in general, this idea of protracted war is not only benefiting from a lot of tabletop exercises, studies, wargaming, analysis of what a conflict in the Indo-Pacific would look like, but it's benefiting from the fact that we have an object, clear example in a protracted conflict in Ukraine, a conflict which some thought would end with the Russian invasion toppling Ukraine's government within just a few days. And now here we are, over 2 years later from the start of the Russian invasion. And it doesn't seem ludicrous anymore to say, hey, this is going to be a protracted, conflict, because we have this, tremendous near-term example of what this could look like. I think one of the other elements, too, that's contributing to this willingness to look at protraction is the understanding of China's effort to coerce Taiwan and its potential to try and blockade Taiwan, which, of course, are both strategies that would fit with a more protracted approach to the conflict that wouldn't necessarily rely on a quick invasion to achieve a decisive outcome, that China itself may be preparing for a much more protracted struggle.
No, that's great. I think a couple things are important. All of that is important. Two things that struck me. The first thing you mentioned was we got to look at deterrence. That if you're not preparing for the right type of character of a war, you may be getting your deterrence values wrong, and then you've got to have the right military capability to prove that your deterrence is right, which also assures your allies and partners, of which the U.S. military and the U.S. government depend upon for support. And the second thing I'll bring up that you mentioned was this idea that, we can study what's going on now in places like the Ukraine and better understand protraction as you escalate that from a smaller type conflict with frankly a military power without that much economic benefit behind, economic resources behind it, because they're not a huge economy, to the global and regional hegemon problem, where you do actually have large economies that intermix with each other. And that's going to be something, how do we do economic warfare as a driver to both stop a potential war, but also help win a protracted one? And that's something that we haven't had to deal with at full scale since World War I, frankly. I think that's a couple important things to take a look at. Let me give the last word to you, Marcus, because number one, you've always got something great to say. And number two, I'm anxious to hear the direction that you want to go with your young center that's just a little bit older than ours.
Right. Thanks, Rich, number one, for this tremendous opportunity to come on your podcast. And so the main point I want to leave everyone with is the importance of working together with allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific to strengthen our ability to fight a geographically expanded and protracted war that might include limited nuclear attacks by our adversaries in order to deter those very possibilities. I think the less prepared we are to fight that protracted war, the more likely it actually is to happen. If it looks like to the PRC, to North Korea, that even if they don't succeed in the first few days or weeks of a conflict, that we lack the staying power to fight a protracted war, that we don't have the will, we don't have the preparedness, we don't have the industrial base, we don't have the ability to mobilize our populations in a variety of ways to fight such a protracted war, that they may be more likely to take that chance, that even if that short, sharp war doesn't work, that the protracted war could still achieve their goals. And so, and this has to be done, again, with allies, with partners in the region. It's uncomfortable. It's politically challenging because people don't want to be told that we have to make sacrifices now for a war that may never come, and we have to make these sorts of preparations and pay these costs and have these policies in place in the event of what to many is an unthinkably painful possibility. But in the end, if we want to avoid a protracted war, if we want to avoid simultaneous conflicts geographically expanded across the Indo-Pacific, if we want to avoid limited nuclear strikes, then we need to be prepared for those possibilities in a way where it's unambiguous that our adversaries will still not be able to achieve their goals, even if the conflict takes those pathways.
All right, Marcus, thank you for your time and your energy in this effort and the work you're doing at the Atlantic Council. And also thanks for being a friend here to the China Land Power Study Center, and appreciate the time you've spent here with us on the podcast. Listeners, you can learn more about the China Land Power Study Center at ssi.army.warcollege.edu/classic, CLSC. For more Army War College podcasts, check out Conversations on Strategy, Decisive Point, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.